Good afternoon. Welcome, everyone, to this side event, how accrediting mechanisms can assist countries in their indices. I am Julia Justo Soto, chair of the Joint Implementation Supervisory Committee. Clearly, countries need to collaborate to achieve success in combating climate change. Indeed, more than 70 countries expressed this explicitly in their INDCs, their intended national determinative contribution. This side event will explore why provisions for such collaboration are needed in the agreement being crafted by parties here in Paris. We will also explore what those provisions could look like. And because we feel that the joint implementation mechanism has a lot to offer, not least in terms of experience, we will share and discuss some of the lessons learned in the implementation of the GI. Now, without further delay, I will hand you over to our moderator, Mr. Benoit Leguet, Managing Director of the Institute for Climate Economics, I4CE, and GI Steering Committee member. Thank you very much for your participation. Ms. Benoit, please.
Thank you, Julia, and welcome everyone to this side event. I will be moderating the roundtable. Today we have four experts at the table. I will try to introduce them briefly. Before doing that, I'll introduce myself, which is not really polite, I know, but I'll start with myself. I'm Benoit Leguet. I'm the Managing Director at I4C, the Institute for Climate Economics, and I've been a member of the JISC for a number of years. If you want to know what I4C does, please refer to our website. I'm not going to go into lengthy descriptions, but all you need to know is we're an initiative by Caisse des Dépôts and Agence Française de Développement, so two major French public financial institutions. Having said that, I guess I will introduce briefly the speakers today. Apart from myself, we have three distinguished panelists. I guess who will start? Marcelo, you will start. Am I okay? So Marcelo, the reason for Marcelo being here today, Marcelo is an advisor with the Brazilian government on UNFCCC issues. He's a lead reviewer of national greenhouse gas inventories under the UNFCCC, and he has a focus on carbon markets, land use change, forestry, and monitoring, reporting, and verification. So I take it he has lots of things to say about how a crediting mechanism can assist countries in their INDCs. Marcelo, if you will.
Well, thank you, everybody, and thank you also for the invitation. It's not common that we can step out of the negotiation and enjoy side events, so I'm happy that that was the case for me today. I want to make a few brief comments on crediting mechanism and the role in the NDCs. I think the first comment is we have to think or to make the question what mechanism we are talking about. It. We know that under the Kyoto Protocol, we have the joint implementation and the CDM, the Clean Development Mechanism. But there is, as I used to say, life outside the United Nations Convention on Climate Change. And we are seeing a lot of initiatives at the national and subnational level of new mechanisms being created or implemented in some cases, also across country. So for the future, since we are talking about the NDCs, we have to take in consideration also this new experience or new examples outside the UNFCCC convention. How we were going to take care of them, or we're going to somehow use them, or more precisely, how countries are going to use them, is up to be decided not only at the national level, but also here in the Paris Agreement. So the starting point is to understand what we are talking about, what mechanism you are talking about. The second thing is that whatever is the mechanism that we are talking about inside or outside UNFCCC, we have to understand that they have to serve the agreement. all of these mechanisms needs to be used in a way not only to fulfill the contributions, in particular the mitigation contributions that we will see in the indices, but to serve the agreement as a whole. Otherwise, it may get the wrong impression that we are here to create an agreement to receive instruments or mechanisms or to create instrument and mechanisms. And I think it's the other way around. We are here to create an agreement that will put us in the track of the 2 degrees or even less increase on the temperature goal level. And whatever is serving this agreement, including credit mechanisms, need to fit for this purpose. So that's another message or comment that I want to stress here. And forgive me if I don't use the example of JI. As you explained, I'm not a really expert, but I guess others will do a better job than me talking about JI. If we take out the example of the CDM, the Clean Development Mechanism, again, was created under the Kyoto Protocol as a credited mechanism to serve the Kyoto Protocol, to help developing countries to promote sustainable development, to help Annex I countries to fulfill their commitments under the Kyoto Protocol. And also, it serves as kind of a stick under the Kyoto Protocol rules. If you are an Annex I country party and you are out of compliance, one of the possible results or penalties of that is that you will not be allowed to use the flexible mechanism, including the CDM and JI. So it serves the agreement, was not created per se, was not created because people would like to trade certified emission reduction. And I guess the same thing applies to JI, was not created for the sake of JI. So we will keep this in mind, and when we try to answer this question of how the credit mechanism can assist countries in the NDCs, let's keep in mind that they have to assist also the agreement. Definitely, in my way of thinking, there's going to be a role for crediting mechanisms in the NDCs and in the Paris Agreement, just because people are doing this and will continue to do, and there is a value in doing such mechanisms, not only in terms of cost reduction, but also, as I said, in the case of the CDM, the sustainable development aspect is very important. So there is definitely a role for the NDCs. The credit mechanism in the NDCs. But it depends, of course, in the type of the NDCs. Some NDCs probably can make better use of credit mechanisms compared to others. So that, I think, is the first layer that we have to take in consideration. Depend on the NDC that we are talking about, some credit mechanism, and as I said, we don't have only to think about the current ones. We also have to think about the future ones. Now we're going to come back about this present versus future mechanism. But the point is that depending on your NDC, some mechanisms will serve better than others. And, of course, it's only the country can decide what mechanism they believe will serve better the NDC. There are another layer is that if this mechanism is what in the jargon, negotiation jargon, now is being called a centralized mechanism. Why I say that? If it's a centralized mechanism, that means that all parties have engaged in the construction of this mechanism, at least in the construction of the modalities and procedures. So therefore, it's a mechanism that everybody is somehow responsible for. And if we are talking about a centralized mechanism, a credit mechanism post-2020, then again, it's up to every country to decide if they want to use it or not. But it's something that in the UNFCCC context, in the context of the Paris Agreement, maybe it's easy to understand and to accept. But if we are talking about that a mechanism that, as I mentioned, exists because people are doing this at national, subnational level or across countries, then the use or the acceptance of this mechanism under the Paris Agreement probably can be subject to some additional questions. In fact, I think part of the discussion that we're going to have in Paris, it will be a little bit about what to do with things that have not been developed or will not be developed under UNFCCC rules. Parties will present these results in the NDCs, And then what? How to treat that? So there is the questions about transparency. There is question about accountability, accounting. There are many questions that we have to somehow try to answer through the modalities and procedures of the Paris Agreement. And when I say modalities and procedures, that means that the answers to these questions will not appear here in Paris. Will need to be developed after Paris when we will have the decisions that will implement, make operationalize the Paris Agreement. But the way I see, definitely there is a role for them. We need to make clear what the role is, and the details will come later. And maybe my final point is that we will not start from zero. None of what I'm saying here is new. I was not there in Kyoto, but what I know is that the similar kind of thinking or discussion or questions happen in Kyoto, happen in Marrakesh when we had the modalities and procedures for JI and CDM. So we will somehow repeat what we did before. And that, I think, is very important. We don't have to start from zero, throw away everything that we have in experience in JI or CDM and start at zero. We can and should use this experience and learn from that, learn from the success, the failures, and make sure that whatever the mechanism that we choose to have under the Paris Agreement, a centralized mechanism or centralized mechanisms, or even recognitions, approvals of outside mechanisms, all of them we need to take on board the experience that we have up to now. This will speed up the process. As I mentioned, none of these details will be developed or decided here in Paris. They are supposed to happen between now and 2020. And, of course, there's a lot of concerns that you know how this process can sometimes be slow, and some people may say, oh, these guys will take 10 years to get to the details. We'll never see these things in place. I don't believe that will be the case. I truly believe that we have the conditions, the ability to develop the details, the modalities and procedures before 2020, to put this in place, maybe even before 2020. There is early actions that people continue to talk about it. And I think here we have also this possibility as well. So I think that are the main messages I would like to leave, and of course be very happy to engage in any discussions later. Thank you.
Thank you, Marcelo. I guess we can give him a round of applause. Okay, thanks, Marcelo, for framing the debate and recalling that whatever mechanism is negotiated needs to serve the purpose of the agreement as a whole. What I liked about the different points you made, the centralized mechanism, the mechanism we are going to discuss today is joint implementation, but what you're flagging is basically that we need to have a joint construction mechanism. In other words, to build this mechanism jointly. That's a very clever point. And your point about experience is also very relevant. We're not starting from zero. And we have 5 years between now and 2020 to elaborate on rules. But I guess Daniel and Roland will possibly provide some feedback as to what the previous years have looked like. Daniel, could you start? So to briefly introduce Daniel, Daniel is with Climate Mundial, and before, he has quite extensive experience in providing finance to mitigation and adaptation projects throughout the world. Prior to being with Climate Mundial, he used to be with JP Morgan, where he was in charge of CDM and JI project activities. So, Daniel, I take it you have quite extensive activity and experience to reflect on.
Thank you very much, Benoit. And I want to just make one quick point here, or observation, is that, you know, in terms of early action and looking at this very much from the private sector investment perspective, when Marcelo has already touched on the mechanisms we have available maybe in the future versus the mechanisms that we have available today. And speaking from the perspective of the private sector, the unfortunate reality about the mechanism of the future is that we can't actually use it right now. So if what we're aiming to do is incentivize early action, which I believe is a key tenet of the discussions in the ADP and is going to be a key principle that will be protected in the Paris Agreement, I would like to leave the message very clearly today that there is an enormous difference for the private sector between what is available for use today versus a theoretical mechanism that may be available at some point in the future that parties may or may not use. On that note, I'd like to say thank you very much to the UNFCCC for the invitation to come here today. And I think this is a very interesting topic because when we look at the use of mechanisms, if we look at the INDCs more broadly, and I'm going to pick a selection of OECD countries who've put forward about 28 billion tonnes of emission reductions in their INDCs. This is really all the OECD countries except for maybe Russia, who actually end up effectively with a surplus under what they've proposed. And 28 billion tonnes is a lot of emission reductions to achieve on your own shores. And so I think one of the key things, if the question is, should mechanisms be part of the Paris Agreement? If we don't use mechanisms, especially when you look at the OECD countries, if we don't use these mechanisms, what we're going to end up with is a compliance cost that's prohibitively high. It's going to be an enormous cost of compliance. And so then what happens then is, faced with enormous compliance costs, the thing that gets toned down is the level of ambition. And from everything that we've seen when we talk about the 2-degree target, I think we need to acknowledge that ambition, if anything, needs to be increased, not reduced. So on that note, I'm going to give you a sneak preview of a paper that I'm of which I'm a co-author, which is going to be released later on this week, where a colleague of mine, Tadia Osmundsen, who's coming to Paris next week. Tadia is a senior vice president for business development at Scatec Solar, which is a Norwegian independent power producer focused specifically on solar PV. And what we did is we looked at the International Energy Agency's assessment of all the INDCs in developing countries, excluding China. And what we found is essentially most of these INDCs are essentially unfunded. So the unconditional commitments are very modest, and the conditional commitments are extremely ambitious. And what we find with the International Energy Agency in their World Energy Outlook, under this scenario, they said we should end up with around 700 gigawatts of new solar and wind energy by 2040. And the reason why they say 2040 is because those INDCs at the moment are unfunded. We don't actually know where the money's coming from. So in order to address the question of how mitigation and climate finance can be enhanced through mechanisms, I think that we need to focus on how mechanisms could actually fast-track those particular plans so that we get the abatement as quickly as we possibly can. And what Tadia and I basically did is we looked at a scenario where instead of achieving all of these INDCs by 2040, we actually we strive towards achieving them in 2025. And this is a particularly important measure because if you think about the IPCC's guidance on this, they've basically said we've got, from 2011 onwards, we've got a global carbon budget of around 1,000 gigatons that we can get through. And the way that the United Nations in their synthesis report said that unless we increase the level of ambition in current INDCs, we may well have consumed 770 gigatons by the time we get to 2030. So any fast tracking of INDCs that can be proposed, and our solution is quite concrete on this, actually saves carbon budget now or in the next few years. And this is extremely valuable because the other thing that the IPCC says is that the least cost scenario is to start now and reduce emissions globally by about 1.6% per annum. Whereas if we wait until after 2030, the emission reductions need to be much greater, in the order of 3.5% to 4%, and they're going to be orders of magnitude more expensive. And the reason why they're going to be orders of magnitude more expensive is because if we don't have the right signals in place now, we might build plant, energy generation plant, fossil fuel plant, which by the time we get to 2030 needs to be retired early. And I'm not sure if a lot of you are following the financial regulation debate in particular in the UK, but the governor of the Reserve Bank or the Bank of England, Mark Carney, has expressed a very serious concern about the financial risks associated with people investing in these assets now, when we know full well that into the future, after 2030 particularly, we're going to be in a much more carbon-constrained world. So Taddy and I looked at the scenario where we fast-tracked these plans, and what we actually found is that for a cost of around $65 billion, we could fast-track this construction of plant, so the 700 gigawatts could be achieved by 2025 with the use of market mechanisms. But not market mechanisms that are developed in the future and are ready by 2020, because in order to implement this by 2025, we need to get on and start building plant today. We need to fund the INDCs. And so therefore, the unfortunate reality about a new market mechanism, as laudable as the concept may be, it doesn't deliver us, in terms of private sector at least, a mechanism that we can use today. The only two mechanisms we can use today with any certainty at all are the Clean Development Mechanism and JI. So the end result is that by spending the extra money, that's by developed countries increasing their ambition above what they've already published, and by agreeing to do that using existing market mechanisms, the cost would be $65 billion or thereabouts US. It would stimulate additional investment in developing countries, all the developing countries other than China, of around $500 billion before 2025, and that we would be able to avoid nearly $150 billion of social cost and of real financial cost after 2030 by doing this action early. So, on that note, if we go back to the question, market mechanisms, are they relevant to the Paris Agreement? I would say they absolutely are. The most important thing to understand is which parties are actually going to use them. I think we're putting forward a scenario that actually is compelling for a whole raft of reasons. It saves money in the long term for developed countries. It fast-tracks the INDC implementation in virtually every developing country. But it requires the mechanisms to be available urgently. And for that, we can only go to the existing mechanisms. So on that note, I'll be happy to discuss this further and answer questions along the way. But I would put forward the case for reformed CDM and JI as opposed to new market mechanisms, if you want to call them that. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Daniel. And your call for urgency is well heard. You talked about early action. You talked about implementing now. I mean, putting the right signals today. Turning over to Roland now. Roland is possibly one of the most advocates of JI in Germany. He's done lots of things, but one of the things I recall from Roland is being one of the true advocates of joint implementation in Germany. And you might be surprised to know that Germany is actually a host country for joint implementation. So, Roland, could you please reflect on your experience with joint implementation in the past years and reflect on what you would like to see in the coming years? Yeah.
Thank you, Benoit. Of course, I'm happy to do so. First of all, I would like to say thank you, Julia, to the GIC for having the opportunity to contribute to that session. And thank you, Benoit, for the very kind introduction. I also will do my contribution while sitting here. You may find more information in the presentation that will be published later on. Well, the title of the side event is Enabling Environment for Effective and Implementation of Mechanisms. Of course, this is meant not only for OECD countries, but for all countries that have delivered INDCs and will be in a situation to fulfill their INDCs in the years to come. I would like to focus on the use of JI and the experiences we gathered under that mechanisms, in the European Union and especially in Germany to reflect on the issue that is raised in the title. Well, Benoit already mentioned that it might be noteworthy to explain a little bit on how JI in Germany was established, because coming as a surprise for many people, in the first years of the first Kyoto Commitment period in 2008 and 2009, Germany was the leading host country for JI and still ranks on the fourth place behind Russia, Ukraine, and Poland. However, compared to other countries, the rules in Germany on JI had been quite tight and clear, and also we had a very good national governance scheme on JI, so the most projects in Germany have been registered under JI First Track without any problems compromising environmental integrity or other issues like that. So the first part of an enabling environment, of course, is to put in place an effective regulation and, of course, to create incentives for somebody else to purchase credits, because if there is no demand for credits, be it international or domestically, could also be domestically, it will become hard to develop projects and to support climate-friendly businesses. Maybe some hints on general rules and the relation to the European Emissions Trading Scheme. Of course, the EU ETS is the leading instrument inside the European Union. This is particularly true for Germany as well. In 2008 to 12, the annual budget on greenhouse gas emissions in Germany was about nearly 1 billion tons of CO2 equivalents. Just to give you a number, about nearly the half, 450 million tons, have been covered by the emissions trading scheme at that time. Of course, all emissions reducing, all activities reducing emissions within sectors or installations covered by the emissions trading scheme were not eligible for JI. So this ruled out any problems of double counting from the very beginning. The general requirements have been defined in a federal act on a so-called federal act on implementing the project-based mechanisms of the Kyoto Protocol. So the reference to the international mechanisms is even made in the national law directly, and we also transposed a lot of detailed rules, for example, on methodologies and other stuff from CDM and JI to our national law. The law inter alia foresees that double counting is ruled out, as I already explained, as well as so-called double subsidizing. So all emission reductions that have favored other subsidies, for example, from our renewable energy law, were not eligible for JI as well. Any reductions implementing legal requirements of the European Union's law or the national law also were not eligible. They were part of the baseline and could not be credited. A problem that we had, I will get back to that later on, was the crediting period. It was clearly restricted from 2008 to 2012. This showed up to be much too short for certain project types. By the way, the mechanism, JI mechanism, was governed by the German Emissions Trading Authority, that was in charge also for a letter of endorsements and letter of approval, so we also had a two-stage approval process in Germany. Maybe some remarks on successful project types and lessons learned. The first larger group of projects, this was not a big surprise, tackled non-CO2 greenhouse gas emissions, especially N2O. These had been very attractive projects with very large emission reductions. However, we had very ambitious baselines. For example, for adipic acid N2O destruction, we already used a destruction rate of 90% as the baseline. So this is a big difference to the projects that had been registered within that type under the CDM. All those projects, especially those in the chemical industry, ended with the end of 2012 because all these emissions, meanwhile, are covered by the European Emissions Trading Scheme as of 2013. So this gives a very clear message: to introduce a project-based mechanism does not hinder to introduce an emissions trading scheme later on or to extend an emissions trading scheme if you start with a smaller scope, as it was the case in Europe as well. A second larger group of projects were so-called programmatic projects. I confess I'm a little bit proud that we were able to get the first POA registered before the CDM POA rules were definitely finalized. So there are two groups of programs that had been developed, one group in the household sector and in the transport sector, so very dispersed sectors, and especially within those sectors, the mechanism was not that successful, mainly due to the much too short crediting period. But there had been another group of programmatic projects that had been more successful, and that was the replacement of boilers in commercial and industrial installations and also within municipal heat supply. In many cases, also including fuel switches from oil to natural gas or to biomass. We had the experience that participation within those programs was quite good, especially if we take into account the barriers that we faced, especially in the years 2008 to 2010. It also showed up that standardization was very helpful. In the case of Germany, we developed standards bottom-up in dialogue with our authority. I'm aware that in other countries, like France, for example, they started with having methodologies available before running projects. We used the other way around, but after a few years, it's nearly the same, I would say. So I would like to come to a few success factors and also to some barriers that we faced. Most important, an important success factor, of course, is simplicity, clarity in the rules, and practicability of criteria. It must be utilizable from businesses as well as from public institutions that are not experts in the mechanisms. Very important also was the very good and deep communication we had with our authority. So the communication between project developers and authority is very important. Of course, the most important success factor was the demand for ERUs. And we had one major source of demand. This was, of course, the European Emissions Trading Scheme. But the second largest source of demand is the voluntary market. A remarkable share of the ERUs created from our projects in Germany at the end have been used for voluntary offsets and not within the emissions trading scheme or sold outside. Let us talk a little bit on barriers. As practice, as you know, is not perfect, we always have to face barriers. In the beginning, Benoit, I guess, reminds that very well. When we had side events like that, I would say 10 years ago, the question was JI what? So nobody knew about the mechanism, and this was especially the case on the basis also inside in Germany. So it took us some time to make people aware that there is a mechanism existing that can reward emission reductions. In Europe, whole Europe, and also in Germany, we were faced with a very deep economic crisis in 2008 and 2009. That was a major barrier because nobody invested anything, especially not in replacement of boilers within this period. Later on, to be honest, we had a little bit of problem with the reputation of the mechanisms at all. CDM as well as JI have been criticized by NGOs inside the European Union heavily, and this also harmed project development inside Germany under JI. Of course, we also were harmed by the price collapse of CERs and ERUs, and again, most notably, the much too short crediting period, especially for the interesting programs on energy efficiency. For those programs, the crediting period of 10 years, or 5 years, excuse me, was much too short. Maybe some conclusions, some lesson learned for offset mechanisms could be domestic offset mechanisms as well as those governed internationally. From my point of view and also driven by our experience, JI, and in fact JI was governed in Germany like a domestic offset mechanism, is a perfect match. It complements perfectly other instruments, of course, especially emission trading schemes, but also carbon taxes or, for example, tendering instruments to deploy financial means to emission reductions. So it was clearly a very helpful tool, but a framework is necessary and it needs to be defined in detail also domestically. In Germany, the JI mechanism was quite successful. We witnessed that we were able to address some potentials that clearly had not been identified before and had not been targeted by other policy instruments. So a project-based mechanism that is open for coming up with new approaches and new ideas fits perfectly into an environment, even such an environment like Germany, that is really full of rules. Also, a lot of instruments on environmental issues already in place. We also learned that this mechanism was attractive for private investors as well as public institutions. For example, some of our federal states run energy efficiency programs and made use of the revenues of from the sales of the ERUs in order to subsidize regional emission reduction activities. On program of activities, this approach is still, in practice, highly innovative, and it's promising, especially on energy efficiency and deployment of renewables also in within smaller installations. But to raise that issue again, they will show their high potential only if we have longer crediting periods, and of course, in order to do so, we need more reliability in the instruments that we would like to use. So finally, a JI-like mechanism, of course JI itself, but also domestic mechanisms inspired by JI, they are able to utilize creativity of project developers, of very different kinds of project developers, and of course to activate large investment volumes. By the way, due to the rules we had in Germany, Germany also witnessed so-called net mitigation benefits from JI, in the order of magnitude of 5 to 8 million tons from 2008 to 2012. Means the emission reductions caused by and brought about by the JI projects were up to 8 million tons larger than the number of ERUs handed over to the project owners. So I would try to encourage you, don't reinvent the wheel. Try to make use of the experiences that are existing so far. Of course, not only in Germany, I just stick to that example. There are many more experiences in other countries as well. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Roland, and thanks for highlighting that we don't need to reinvent the wheel, that we have some experience. But I guess I've heard the previous speakers say just about the same thing, so it's quite encouraging. I now have a short presentation on my own reflections on joint implementation. What I've done is I've tried to highlight how a crediting mechanism can assist countries in their INDCs using the reflection on JI. Two things I need to mention. First of all, I foresee, or the Institute, which was previously known, had a different name, but is now I foresee, published in 2012 a report on joint implementation. It is downloadable on our website. And second, France is also a host country for joint implementation projects. If I'm not mistaken, we're number 5 behind Germany. So we lost. We're not on the podium anymore, but we are a quite heavy joint implementation host country. I'll keep it quite short. All I have for you, my 2 cents for this side event, are basically 3 lessons from the experience with the design and operation of joint implementation. So if you can count to 3, you can hopefully keep in mind what I'll say. Before we set out on this 3 lessons, what I would like to highlight, one thing you need to know, domestic crediting mechanisms, and I'm not talking about JI here, I'm talking about everything that looks and resembles JI, they are no offsets. Please do not say offsets when you talk about JI. This is a domestic policy tool. That's what it needs to be considered like. It's a policy tool at the disposal of countries that want to achieve emission reductions. It is not an offset at all. And what you can see on this map is all the geographical zones that have implemented or are in the process of implementing domestic offsets. I won't call them JI because they're not all JI. Some of them are JI, but some of them are not, but they are all domestic offset projects. But the most important part in this case is not offset, it is domestic policy. And please keep in mind, it is a policy at the disposal of host countries. Okay, moving on to the lessons. First of all, now that you know that it's not an offset, but it's a policy tool, what I would like to say is that JI is a flexible policy tool. It's been said inter alia by Roland. A couple of JI projects that you might want to know about. very large project. This, for example, in Russia, industry sector, I just can't recall what it is, possibly steel manufacturing or something, possibly very large industry, hundreds of thousands tons of equivalent CO2 of emission reductions each year. So large projects in the industry sector. Second type of project, and this is quite different, agriculture, and that's one of the projects we have in France. This is a program of activities, but it's a program of large projects. So we're not talking about small projects. We're talking about 15 similar projects in the agricultural sector switching from coal to biomass. Mind you, we use coal in France as well. We have nuclear power, etc. But we also use coal for lots of industrial purposes. And on these projects, we decided to switch from coal to biomass in the agriculture sector, which implies lots of process modifications upstream to be able to use biomass instead of coal, not only in the energy in terms of energy, but also in terms of process of the raw material being processed. Third example, and this is quite unique too, Germany, that was one of the examples provided by Roland, in the household sector, we're talking about energy efficiency here, and if I'm not mistaken, on this specific project, it was implemented by a subnational government. So the subnational government was the player implementing the project, which is quite unique. As far as I know, not that many projects have been carried out by subnational governments, but it's possible to do so, provided there's a clear framework for doing so. So lesson one, flexible policy tool. You can do just about whatever you want to do with joint implementation and finance, whatever kind of project you want to finance. Lesson two, and this was also a point of interest in the previous presentations, joint implementation helps parties comply in a static perspective. This is what was inter alia presented by Roland. This is a Ukrainian project. I can't recall what it, well, it's possibly adipic acid or something similar in Ukraine. The project developer was only, quote-unquote, awarded a portion of the carbon rent. In other words, a portion of the emission reductions generated. That's what you can see on the, that's the yellow part. And the Ukrainian government decided to keep for itself the blue part. So basically the baseline was set a little bit too high, quote-unquote, a little bit higher than the business as usual, or a little bit lower, depending on which case you look at it, on which way you look at it. Same thing for France, my host country, my home country in this case. The business as usual was the top line you have on this project, which is also a chemistry project in adipic acid sector, if I'm not mistaken. National regulations were above the business as usual, so some regulations had been implemented, and as Roland pointed out, this doesn't hamper the development of joint implementation projects. Some regional regulations had been implemented on top of the national regulations, and the baseline had been set on top of those regional regulations. So why was that? That was because the country, the government, the French government, wanted to keep a portion of the carbon rent for itself. So the project developer only, quote-unquote, got the yellow part, which is small compared to the emission reductions, but hopefully was high enough to let the project flow. So the lesson here is that if parties want to use it to improve their compliance status, they can do so by playing, quote-unquote, on the baseline and yielding a lower rent to the project developer. That's in a static perspective. Now, let's have a look from a dynamic perspective, bearing in mind that time doesn't stop after the Paris conference. There will be a 2020 agreement, if I'm not mistaken, and possibly some work to do after 2020. So in a more dynamic view, in a more dynamic perspective, this is what joint implementation can do. It can help raise ambition throughout time. If we have a look at those fertilizer production projects, well, first of all, it was not really on the radar screen of policymakers. They didn't really know we could do something in terms of emission reductions on this sector, this specific sector. And it was supposed to be a quite difficult sector for monitoring, reporting, and verification. Well, the good piece of news is if you let those project developers have credits, they can, by a touch of magic wand, provide some sound monitoring, reporting, and verification processes. And the other thing you need to know is the sector was included in the UTS from 2013 onwards, but project developers already knew that the sector would be included in the UTS onwards. So their interest was to develop a domestic offset project, joint implementation project in this case, get some emission reductions, get some credit for early action, and go with the project. So the good piece of news, I mean, I hope you can see it on this graph. All the blue dots represent one of the EU installations producing nitric acid. 42 of those 83 installations were joint implementation projects. The minimum baseline was set at 4.5 kilograms of N2O per ton of nitric acid. And thanks to the data that was gathered from the joint implementation projects, the regulator was able to set a quite stringent threshold for the best performing installations, which was then used in the UETS as a benchmark for including those installations in the UETS. So the lesson here is that joint implementation possibly helped the regulators in Europe to introduce a quite stringent standard and benchmark for the EU ETS. So that's what I would call the help to raise ambition function of joint implementation over time. Obviously, you can do this over a given period, and you can do this periodically. I mean, tomorrow's best performing, today's best performing installation can become tomorrow's minimum baseline, for example. And in a dynamic setting, this can become extremely interesting. So that was my third lesson. If you are a host country, you can hopefully use a crediting mechanism, domestic crediting mechanism, to raise ambition throughout time. And I understand ambition will be needed. If I heard what Daniel said, we'll need ambition in the coming years. Okay, now the final slide is the concluding remark. If we have a look at the domestic crediting mechanism in a post-2020 regime, today, JI and JI-like mechanisms are small compared to the CDM and compared to their potential. However, if you have a look at the sense of history, crediting mechanisms under an INDC tomorrow could become big, because it will be crediting mechanism under a greenhouse gas trajectory. So it won't look exactly like joint implementation, but it won't look like CDM. It will be somewhere in between JI and CDM. My sense is that it will look a little bit more like JI than CDM, because you need to take into account a trajectory, which is not a hard cap, but it's a trajectory anyway. So my sense is that those type of mechanisms are likely to grow. For example, in the UETS, we have an ongoing discussion for domestic crediting mechanisms in the EU, part of the Climate and Energy Package 2030. So we'll look forward to what the European Union is doing, and hopefully other regions will join us to implement domestic crediting mechanisms. Having said that, if you want to download the report, it's on our website. We also have a Twitter account, so please follow us. Thank you. Okay, now with my moderator cap, I guess, do we have any questions? Maybe some comments from the panel first. I'm just watching them. Nope, yes. We'll come back to it, Daniel.
Yeah, maybe if I can just make one comment about, having a discussion before with Marcelo about Brazil's INDC. And I think Brazil's a very interesting case in point, and to highlight exactly what Benoit's just been saying. Brazil's INDC proposal is for a hard cap with, I think, a 37% reduction by possibly 2025, but at the outside limit, 2030. So that's a hard cap in Brazil, which is possibly a bit more ambitious than a lot of OECD countries even. But Brazil has traditionally been a CDM country, non-Annex 1, whereas now they're going into an environment where they have a cap. So in terms of crediting mechanisms, looks like what we could end up with in a place like Brazil is something that's very similar to CDM, but it's perhaps applied in the context of a capped environment in the same way that JI is used. And I think what Benoit has been saying is we have so much knowledge about doing that now that there's very little point in going back and reinventing an entire approach here, especially in the context of Brazil. And Brazil's just one of the developing countries. There are many others. I've seen a lot of the INDCs propose fixed emission reductions based on a business-as-usual projection. But as long as we all agree what business-as-usual is, that looks a lot like a cap. I think, Jay, I agree with what Ben was saying, is we might well find that the approach starts to become a lot like JI, using methodologies, of course, and the multilateral governance process of CDM. So I have to agree. JI, as much as it's suffered in the recent past because of price issues and so forth, may well be something, even if we don't call it JI, that we use a lot in the future.
Okay. Marcelo?
Yes, thank you. Now, since Daniel used Brazil as an example, I would like to take the opportunity to give a little bit more information about what is going on down there. In fact, we have this ENDC that we have bring to the table here in Paris, and there is still a lot of debate internally in Brazil how this will be, in fact, implemented. So there is discussions around mechanisms, taxes, programs, finance. So I think the main point here is that we don't foresee that one single bullet will get there. We're going to put us in place. So any mechanism is one tool that we hope we have available. But any NDC, in particular cases like Brazil that are quite ambitious, will have to use several tools available. Some of them are related to mechanisms. Others are not related to mechanisms. So I think we have to keep this in mind. At this moment in time, we are not yet deciding what to use, how to use, because, of course, depend a lot on what we're going to decide here in Paris and how we're going to operationalize Paris as well. And then maybe the second point that I want to make, I think for post-2020, it doesn't really matter how we call it. We may call it CDM Plus, we may call JI 2.0, we may give an... whatever name we want. The important thing is whatever it is, and I like what you said, is based on what we have today. Because this is where we have real people making real investment and making real reductions. And all of this experience cannot just be ignored and say, well, we just have to have a new name and new rules behind this new name. No, I think we may end up with a new name, but whatever it is called, it will build up on what we have now, that is the CDM and the AI. And then you use a term that I personally don't like, that we have to reform them. I don't think we have to reform them. We have to enhance them. We have to make them better. Because at least for our understanding, reform is a kind of a pejorative word. You know, you have an old house almost bringing down, and then you have to reform the house to be able to live there again. I don't think it's the case of CDM and JI. The houses are there. They are not going down. For sure, we have to improve the houses, but I would not call it reform.
All right. Now we'll turn to the audience for any questions. Yes, Jos.
Jos Kozijnse, Environment Defense Fund. Thank you for the podium. Because first I saw in the program JISC and JI, I think, hey, that's interesting. Because for me personally, JI will never live, and in the future more and more, because more and more we will see capped nations and trading amongst each other, JI. But what I heard in the podium was interesting. Daniel said clearly, mechanisms have a future now, because Paris will lead to some agreement. Everybody knows it's not enough. So some ask themselves, how can we prepare nations for further actions later? People say, well, long lead time, policies, we need a lot of time. The good thing is mechanisms, you can do it now, you can secure reductions now, we have some CDMs already, we can do more RED now, we can do more JI now. Credits, you can secure them and use them for compliance later. It's cheaper now, you comply with them later. So we see a future in that. There was some different views in the panel, I think, about what do we need now in the Paris Agreement. We have already JI, can we just use it or a different name? Or do we just accept them, that they are there? So what do we need? Not a lot of rules, I guess, because we have a lot of practice. The purpose should be clear, the house we were building. But the reductions are obvious. The atmosphere sees reductions. That's what we need. So what do we need from Paris so that the companies know they can continue finding reductions and using market mechanisms or other reductions, finance is also possible. So what do we need from here? Just a little bit. That we say, okay, JI is out there, we may use it. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Jos. While the panelists are putting their brains together, any additional question? There is one in the back, Cyril.
Merci, Benoît. Cyril from Enerdata in France. The question is, we see that we have GI and CDM on the rules under UNFCCC, and more domestic level as offsettings, like in China, who's try to put in place a carbon market or things like that. How can we move forward to get a more international unified way to make GI or CDM use everywhere and to help them to implement it at domestic level as well? Because China move away from CDM CERs to Chinese CCERs, so probably we can help the different countries to go more on offsettings.
Okay, no other question for the time being. All right, so we have two questions. What do we need in the Paris Agreement, and how can we move towards a more global harmonized scheme, if I got the question right? Roland? Yes.
Yeah, I guess one important part of having a mechanism in place that is international supervision and guidance, at least to a certain extent. And the more parties wish to have international market instruments, the more international supervision and guidance we need, of course. This is also a very clear experience from GI. I would not like to raise all the issues that had happened in the past, but it clearly shows that some supervision and guidance is helpful. It's not about binding countries, but making sure that there is a common interest in environmental integrity of mechanisms and also in proper utilization of the credits generated. As long as GI or CDM or GI CDM-like mechanisms are used as a domestic fulfillment instrument, like it is the case, for example, within the examples showed by Benoit on his slide, I guess even in that case, international, I would then call it not supervision, but guidance is very helpful. And there is a very, very big toolbox, of course, mainly from the CDM, but meanwhile also from GI. And GI's toolbox is also including all the national regulations that have been more exhausting than the national CDM regulations. So I think that at least is a role that even as a minimum target and a minimum role for international institutions, from my point of view.
Okay. Yeah, I think I would like to add, if we were to talk about our wish list of what would come out of this conference, if our goal is to encourage the private sector to be as active as they possibly can be in finding investment opportunities and investing in mitigation pre-2020, the best thing that the Paris Agreement could do is it could recognise CERs and possibly ERUs under the right arrangements that are issued prior to the end of 2020 for compliance with the mitigation commitments of countries after 2020. I think this is possibly one of the most important things that the agreement in Paris could do. And the reason why that's important, I mean, you'll all be familiar with the EU ETS, and you'll know that even before the Market Stability Reserve policy was introduced last year, we had a surplus of EUAs, the certificates in the EU trading scheme, of more than 2 billion tonnes. So it was more than 1 year's emissions surplus in the market. Yet we had prices that were above zero, you know, so ranging between 5 and 7 euros. And rather than, you know, sort of question equilibrium theory on pricing and question whether supply and demand dynamics need to be redrawn up, the reason for that is because the people who trade EUAs have absolute certainty that any EUA that was issued in the trading period between 2013 and 2020 is completely bankable and can be taken across after 2020 and used for compliance. So that's why, even if we've got an oversupplied market, we have a price. And that's because people perceive that the reductions will become more aggressive in the future, the scarcity will return, and so there's a price. And unfortunately, with CERs and ERUs issued up until 2020, we don't know. As a private sector investor, you're taking a huge leap of faith to invest in a pre 2020 CER or ERU because you just don't have the clarity from this forum. So that would be my most important wish list most important item for the wish list.
I want to follow up in this line of thought because I think this question, what we need in the Paris Agreement, is the $1 million question that we have to answer by the end of the next week. In fact, today, each party have his own answer in the pocket, but the problem is that we have to have one single answer only in the agreement. We cannot have 195 different answers, otherwise cannot operationalize that agreement. And I think whatever is the answer, I think that's the message that maybe is the most important message. The signal to private sector that whatever is the instrument, whatever we call it, is something that you can trust, you can invest. There is a room for you to play and to continue to play. More important than that, not to start playing, but to continue to play. And you mentioned also another thing that is very important. JI and CDM are in place. Some of these projects are relatively new, and they will continue to promote emission reductions. Doesn't matter if 2020, because for them, they have a life cycle that goes beyond that, a crediting period in the case of CDM that goes beyond 2020. So for these investments that they have already made, I think that is another important piece of information. What happens with you after 2020? Sorry, you are not eligible anymore, you don't fit in the agreement anymore. We have to answer that question as well. And in principle, I think everybody that have produced emission reductions pre-2020, but they have not been used for compliance or for in the voluntary case, voluntary cancellation, for example, in our way of thinking, have a role to play post-2020. It's a difficult question to answer because, of course, we have to take in consideration many aspects, in particular regard to environmental integrity and how this will affect or not the ambition point post-2020. But definitely, I think I'm in line with you. Whatever is the answer, the message is should be clear to private sector that there is room, there will continue to be room for them. And then maybe to try to answer, if I got you right, about how to harmonize all of these different national approaches. That's another very important question, and unfortunately is a very difficult one to answer because this agreement is based on NDCs, ENDCs now and then in the future NDCs. So they are national determinate. So doesn't matter what we build here, countries will continue to do things that are appropriate for them and will be based on national rules, circumstances. And to get to a level of harmonization, I don't think it's possible or desirable. So we're going to have to live with differences. We're going to have to live with things that doesn't necessarily fit together. And I think this is the beautiful of this new agreement, that we'll take in consideration that there is different things in the world. And we cannot try to make everything equal because they are not. So there is a balance here, and it's not an easy balance to find. But I will not try to push to any extreme, saying everything goes. So whatever you do, we are happy with that. No, I don't think is that the case. But the other extreme also I don't think is valid, to try to put everybody in the same single box, because there is no single box for everybody.
Additionally, it's very important to comment that in the steering committee of the joint implementation, so we evaluated work in only one system for CDN and joint implementation. This is very important in order to reduce the different efforts. For that, tomorrow we are going to present the report and the CMP, no, what we indicated, no, that we, it's very important to revise our GI guidelines.
And if I may bring my two cents to the question, what do we need in the Paris Agreement and how can we move towards a more harmonized scheme? I would say the key lies in transparency. I believe what the UNFCCC can bring to the process is transparency, both to the this transparency will be beneficial both to the investors and the people who put their money in emission reductions, because when you're in a given country, it's sometimes very difficult to understand what the process is. And if you're from outside and you want to understand what is going on in a given country, it's very difficult to understand what is going on, either in terms of CDM, but even more JI, because it's in a national language, etc. So I guess, well, the computer died on me, sorry. I guess what the UNFCCC could bring is transparency. That was my point, to bring clarity to the process. I don't believe we're going to have tomorrow one joint scheme, one global scheme for everything, but we can at least work towards that. And I guess the proposal by the JISC, which we've made repeatedly for the past years, to have one single scheme, for example, for joint implementation, would go towards this transparency, help to alleviate this transparency concern.
I would like to just add, in terms of, you know, answering that question there, the problem that you have when you start breaking off and having national schemes here, there and everywhere, as laudable as that is, you know, everyone wants to take control of their own destiny and all the rest of it. Unless we've got the UN involved and establishing the standards here, we don't actually really know if the ton that we refer to in country X's scheme and country Y's scheme over there, are they the same ton? And giving you a very extreme example, you know, when we're talking about the CDM or in some, you know, many cases JI, but CDM specifically, the additionality question is fundamental because it's a binary decision. Is this an additional project or not? Because if it's not additional, you don't get any CERs. Whereas you might have some other standard somewhere else that another country is using where additionality is not assessed in the same way, and they're quoting this enormous amount of emission reductions. Now, like it or not, climate change is a quantitative pursuit. What matters are the numbers. So I don't think we can... And investors, you know, investors don't like having different standards in applications. So if we want private sector engagement, we want everyone to believe when someone quotes a ton that they actually have a ton. I don't think we have a choice.
Okay. Any other question? Okay, I'll auction the last question. Who wants it? Okay, well, I'll take it as a collective no. So I will hand over now to Julia for closing the meeting.
Thank you very much for your participation. It is very important to discuss in this moment about the different roles of CDM and the joint implementation. They have very important activities and the dynamic of the different countries. For example, in my country, it mobilized more than for 5 billion of the new investment, for example, in Peru. So we see that this instrument has present a different experience for in different countries. No? So we see that in this code, we wait good decisions about these marketing instruments. No, we invite tomorrow for participating in our report that we are going to present to the CMP 11, the Protocol of Kyoto. Thank you very much for your participation all the time.